Good morning, everyone. Really good to see you all here this morning. I'm so glad that you have come out for this session this morning. My name is Keith Stanglin, and I'm the director of the Center for Christian Studies. I live in Austin, and I want to introduce you to my colleague, also Todd Hall, who's the associate director of the center. His wife, Kara, is around here, too, so you'll see her over there. They came with as well. So I want to, before we get into our topic this morning, just take about 5 or 10 minutes here and tell you about the Center for Christian Studies, what this ministry is all about. That's what we're doing here is as representatives of that ministry. So you see the table back there. I just want to direct your attention to it. I'll say a few things about the resources that are back there here in just a second. But what this ministry does is we produce resources for churches and for Christians to use to help equip them in their knowledge of Christian faith. So that's a pretty broad point there. I just want to reflect for just a moment on the reason for this. And the reason for this is because we look around at churches, especially churches in the United States, and especially churches of Christ, and see churches that are overall in numerical decline. Okay? And that itself comes with a lot of implications and consequences. When churches are in numerical decline, that means there are fewer people going into full-time ministry. And that's true. We see that across the board. Which means, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but many of our Christian colleges are closing or consolidating their schools of theology where they train ministers, right? Because fewer are going into it. There are fewer churches that are able to support full-time ministers. In fact, I was talking about this with a group yesterday. 68% of churches in the United States, and that includes all churches, all denominations, everyone, 68% of churches are fewer than 100 members. So two-thirds of the churches in this country are what we normally kind of think of as small churches, 100 or less. All right. So if you're in a church that's more than 100, you are in the minority of churches there, only a third of the church. Well, again, what that means is that we have to start thinking about how to equip people in our churches to do maybe what a lot of the small churches and larger churches used to kind of assume the ministers would do or we would pay someone to do. Can't do that anymore. Okay, you don't have that luxury anymore. And so we look around and we see a need to equip Bible class teachers, elders, deacons, people who just want to know more about their faith and be able to articulate it to others, to pass on the faith to others, to pass on the faith to their own children and the youth in our churches, who are also, you may know, we're losing them, okay, at a rate that is not very comfortable. So there's that. There is just, even with the church members we have, even with the churches that are strong, there is a lower rate of biblical literacy. There are data that back this up as well. But people don't read the Bible. We don't know the Bible like we used to. So there's a decline in biblical literacy, a decline in theological understanding, a decline in just people knowing what their faith is about. And so, along with that, an inability to stand up, I think, to a culture that is increasingly hostile to Christian faith. So looking around where we are now in our culture, some of this we're going to talk about later today, thinking about the broad sweep of church history, I don't really think it's a time where we can kind of sit back, put our legs up, you know, and recline and say, yeah, I think we've done a good job. And now we can take it easy. You know, we are as well equipped and as you know, well educated and well prepared to face the challenges of our culture as we have ever been. No, I don't think we can look around and say that. So at this time, I think more than any other, we need good resources. Not just one ministry that does this. We need a lot of people that are providing resources for churches. So that's where we stepped in as the Center for Christian Studies. We're a nonprofit ministry that started just over 2 years ago. And like I say, we provide resources for churches. Those resources come in different forms. So we have a journal that we publish 3 times a year. And it, I will direct your attention to Todd at the back. Vanna at the back table there is showing you examples of our journal. Each journal is focused on a theme that is of significance to our theology and our practice in churches. The most recent issue was on the book of Revelation. So we have our commission articles from different scholars and ministers to talk about that particular theme. So each one of these is like a little book on whatever the theme is. 3 of those are published every year. They're intended especially for ministers and elders and anybody who really wants to dig deeper. Okay. So that the journal is one thing we do. We have books that we do, brand new books, and also old ones like Preparing for Baptism. But the new books are a curriculum that's meant especially for small group studies, Bible adult Bible classes, or anyone who just wants to learn more about the faith. So we have books that are a series on biblical books. All of these books, these are the kinds of things you can put into the hands of teachers. So that's one of our passions, is equipping especially Bible class teachers. Of course, people can do whatever they want with our resources, and churches do that. But we really have in mind, what can we do to help Bible class teachers? In Churches of Christ, in my experience, we often, if we're proactive or intentional at all about our education, we pick someone that we think will be a good Bible teacher, and we just kind of throw them in the deep end. You know, the pool, and, you know, what do they have to go on? You know, Google it, all right? Or whatever model they, you know, learned when they were in Bible class, whatever they saw, which might have been a really good teacher they learned from, might not have been, you know, what kind of habits they picked up. But we just kind of throw them in the deep end there without much equipment and training. So these books are things that experienced teachers would do well to have in hand. They come with discussion questions, not just shoved at the end of the chapter, but throughout, you know, logically where they should appear in the chapter. They come also, I don't know any other curriculum that does this. We're really happy about this. We ask all of our authors to write discipleship prompts, at least one in every chapter, which is a way for the author to say, how should you be putting what you're learning into practice? And so it's suggestions for practical things to do and say and be based on what they're learning from this biblical book. Okay. So you can put that into the hand, like I said, experienced teachers, but I really like that you can put these books into the hands of new teachers, people who don't have a lot of experience, but here they have good basic commentary, illustrations, applications, discussion questions that will help give them confidence as they're going in to teach. So in some ways, what we're doing with our resources, I would say, is providing floaties for people that we've just thrown into the deep end there, okay? And the deeper you get into this, more detailed swimming lessons, all right? So there's that. We also have video courses that are available through our website. So I know there's a ton of videos out there, YouTube, anything. What our videos are, I would say, is college-level sort of material on particular topics. So again, we're thinking with these, what can we do to provide something for people who, let's say, didn't go to preaching school, didn't go to seminary, didn't go take a Bible degree somewhere, but they're leading in churches, okay? They're teaching Bible classes. What does that person need to know about how to interpret the Bible? The basics. What would we want that person to know about Christian ethics? What would we like for that person to know about just how to teach Bible classes? about how we got the Bible. Where the Bible comes from. How do we get this?
Right.
Baptism, assembly, Lord's Supper, theology of worship. All of these things are video courses that we have. They're taught by people, like everything we do, people who are experts in the field. So you know you're getting reliable stuff. You didn't just YouTube it. It's not just somebody who read a book on this and is spouting off about it. This is original content from people who are the ones writing the books on these things. Okay, people who have terminal degrees in the field. So one of our mottos, you can see on our sign back there, is scholarship for the church. We really think both of those points are important. It's scholarship. You can know that anything you read or listen to or engage in the Center for Christian Studies is going to be done by scholars, people who know what they're talking about. The information is reliable and trustworthy, okay? But it's for the church. These are people who are that write this content, that present these videos, people who teach and minister in churches. And so they know what churches need. They know how to make it accessible to non-specialists. That's what we're about, is bridging that gap. And I think there is a gap between, let's say, the academy, the universities, the scholarship on the one hand, and what churches are doing on the ground. So we are a church-facing ministry here to help churches. The final resource also is the videos. Churches can subscribe to those. The church here at downtown, not everyone here is from the downtown congregation, but the congregation here has a subscription very recently to those videos. So actually tomorrow morning, what we're doing in the class is talking about how to, we're going to just do a demo of the videos, talk about them, best practices, best ways and suggestions we have for using them. So if you're here at the downtown church, I hope you'll come to that class tomorrow morning. You all have access to that 24/7, okay, from your device, your computer or your phone. The last thing we do is just, I would say, in-person and live instruction. What we're doing here today is part of that, okay? So you're experiencing, engaging here in live instruction. Because we recognize, look, some people aren't going to read the journal. Some people aren't going maybe to engage the videos. But a live session like this, I think, is also just an invaluable supplement to and getting the word out about, like we're going to talk about today, leading through cultural change. So that's what we do. I hope you'll visit that today. We're going to have a couple of breaks, like Greg said, so I'll try to be watching the clock here as we go through. But I've got a sign-up sheet in the back there that's just asking for your name and email address. What that will do is just put you on our list to receive emails every week or two about what we're doing in the new content we're releasing, when a new journal comes out, when, you know, we've got a blog post that you would benefit from, when new videos are being released. That's just a way to keep up with what we're doing. So put your email address down there. If you want to subscribe to the journal, so I'm not selling things. All the things that are back there, you can get from our website, okay, and links from our website. The website's up here, christian-studies.org. It's on the inside of this brochure that's on your table and on my card back there. So visit the website's the best place to go to see all the things we have. Okay, it's more than I can say here in 5 or 10 minutes. But the journal, if you want to subscribe to it, there is a QR code back there that Todd is holding up again. Thank you, Todd. Beautiful. That takes you to our website. You'll just go to our website. You don't do QR codes on your phone, I understand. Just go to the website. You'll see Journal of Christian Studies there. And if you subscribe to it today, show us, hey, yeah, subscribe to it. You know, you enter your credit card information, then you can take one of those back issues there. We have 7 or 8 back issues that we've done in the last 2.5 years. So, and you can just go look at the topics. You can order all those from our website as well. There's a catalog of stuff. There's a few things you can take, brochures. There's a catalog of all of our books and journals and videos there as well. Is that everything, Tom? Just sort of, okay. All right. But we're here, ask questions, talk to us about it. The center, we're really happy to answer your questions. Let's get into our topic for today then. Again, my goal is to give us probably a 5-minute break. I've got a lot of stuff I want to say today. So we're going to take a 5-minute break probably at the top of the hour and the next hour as well. So just know that's coming. But yeah, if you want to eat, drink your coffee, all that, get refills while we're doing this, feel free. I'm going to try also to leave a couple minutes for questions at the end, okay? If you have something I need to clarify or whatever, feel free to raise your hand and talk. That's exactly what I want this to be. But if it's a more substantive question or comment, maybe save that, and I'll try to leave some room at the end of each of these three sessions for a little bit of discussion or Q&A. It was over a century ago that a poet called Jenny Wilson wrote some verses that began like this. Time is filled with swift transition. Right. I heard that misquoted once as time is filled with swift transgression. Swift transgression, which is also true. Very true. Right. But time is filled with swift transition, which sometimes these old songs or the poems need a little bit of just translating for us. All it's saying is time is filled with rapid change, right? Rapid change. Naught of earth unmoved can stand. Nothing earthly can remain unchanged. All right. When I sing that or say that, I think, if only Miss Jenny could see us today. You thought there was rapid change at the turn of the 20th century. You haven't seen the 21st century yet, okay? Well, what's the solution that she recommends? Gotta sing the rest of the song. Build your hopes on things eternal. Hold God's unchanging. Church, what? Okay, no, we don't have to. All right. So, hold to God's unchanging. If you don't get anything else out of this today, that really sums up what this is about. Okay, that's probably a dangerous thing to do at the beginning here, y'all. I'm done. Okay. No, it's going to be good, but just if you forget later on or someone asks you, what was this about? Just pull out the hymnal, all right? That's what this is. This rapid change of earthly life and everything earthly on the one hand versus divine stability, right? And so that's what we're talking about today, is just this idea of cultural change. There is change, all right? Change is inevitable. Change is typical. We expect it. But I think that's eternal also. That's the one thing that doesn't change, okay? Change. What's new, though, is the rapidity of the change, really. And that's what I think Jenny Wilson would be surprised about. The speed of the change is aided by technology. Just think about it. It's aided by all kinds of technologies, all right? And that's part of the change itself that then enables more change. So for most of human history, like the biggest technology was the hand axe. You know, humans got by with the hand axe. You know, basically take a rock and hit stuff with it, all right, and break stuff up, all right? And that worked for a long, long time. And then, you know, the next thing and the next thing, you know, and then it's like a few thousand or a few hundred years later, you get iron, which has a lot of ramifications. Like all technologies, it's got some very positive uses. Most ancient people on the ground, not the kings, most of the peasants, thought this is really terrible. Because you can kill a lot more people a lot faster with iron, right? Your armies are much better equipped now. You've got more weaponry than the others. That's how technologies have been. There's some good things that people mean when they make it, and there's some bad things. Change is enormous. It's hard to process. And then it's not a few thousand years later, or a few hundred years later, or a few decades later, a huge world-changing technology is invented. The printing press. Huge. Hard to overstate the implications of that that we're not even aware of growing up, 500 years after. It was huge. Industrial Revolution. Greater mobility, transportation, combustion engine, all of those things, and then the internet, the smartphones. Okay. So these things are happening every few years now, or every few months. You know, if you have an iPhone 5, what is it? What do you have now? iPhone 5? I mean, that's got to be ancient. You know, your iPhone is more than 2 years old. How do you even use it anymore?
I have a 7, so.
I don't even have one, so but I'm sure there's, $1,000 iPhone 20 or something up there now. You get what I'm saying, right? The technologies have hastened the changes that have happened in our society, and it's hard to keep up. On April 8th of this year, there was a total solar eclipse that passed through Texas. I don't think it passed, the totality was not in Midland, am I correct?
No.
Okay. But did any of you here see the totality?
Yes.
I'll take you. Here.
No, in person. Did anyone see it? Sorry, yeah. Anybody go to see it?
Yeah.
Nobody did. Okay. Wow. All right. It came through Austin, and it was for about a minute. But for two reasons, I decided to drive. I was able to, it was I think a Monday or a Tuesday, I was able to take some time. And I drove for two reasons. One is they're forecasting clouds in Austin, but not so much west. And you can see more. So I drove just an hour northwest. I drove to Burnet. And it was clear at the time, and for over 4 minutes, the sun was obscured totally by the moon, and it was really something. I mean, I knew what to expect. I knew it was going to happen, right? I heard about it, seen pictures of it, whatever. I'd seen partial before, where I'm looking at a card and there's like a light and a little moon crescent over it. So I thought, well, I'll try this. I'm telling you, it was spectacular. It's just hard to explain how amazing the sight was. I knew what it was going to be, but it was just so cool. It really was. So I was glad I did that. Why am I bringing that up? It was just interesting to me that I looked at a website, weeks before, that had exactly when and where this eclipse was going to be. Right, and it had like a shadow of the moon going over Texas, and you could see where it was going. The full circle was going, and we were just on the edges. It was going to be only for a minute or less. And that's why I knew to drive right to the middle of that circle. I'd see it for longer, exactly the right time. It just struck me, man. We sure know how to. Somebody knows how to predict these things. Some very talented mathematicians and astronomers figured this out with great accuracy. And it reminded me of, see if I can get this to work, Matthew 16. In fact, I'll just open this up. Brought your Bibles. We looked at a few passages here. Matthew chapter 16, and the verse is 2. Jesus. When evening comes, you say, Jesus speaking, when evening comes, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. I just gave sort of my literal translation up there. On the one hand, the face of the sky, you know to discern. But on the other hand, signs of the times, you cannot discern. Leave the verb out there. You cannot discern it. So the irony that Jesus is pointing to, that you know how to predict the weather, and I would say, we know where the moon's going to be, you know, with such great precision. It really is impressive. But you don't understand other very important things going on around you, right? You're observant about some very cool things, Jesus says, right? That's nice. But the most important matters you don't see. So I think the lesson here, one lesson here, is we should give at least as much attention to matters more important than the weather and astronomy. That's cool. Again, we can predict these things with great accuracy. Weather, not so much, but sometimes great accuracy. It's going to be hot today. The eclipse, again, it's just very impressive. We understand correlation and physical cause and effect very well. But then we're so ignorant, it seems like sometimes, about the patterns and the correlations and the effects that things have on us and on our lives. Why is that? Just some examples here that came to my mind. What if you give children portable handheld screens with constant connection to the internet and social media access with little or no restrictions? What do you think is going to happen? Could we have possibly predicted what might happen with that? Yeah, bad things can happen. And they have. Yet we do it anyway, and we seem surprised about it. Tell those same people that we just handed these things to, that it's up to them in this vulnerable stage of adolescence to choose their identity, including their sexual orientation and their gender expression. And then watch as the depression levels and the suicidal ideation skyrockets. And then act surprised. We wonder why. Tell an already lonely and isolated population that it's a virtue to stay away from each other and socially distance. We did that. I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, about 4 years ago. I'm not saying there wasn't, you know, a reason behind any of this, but it's like, did we know what the consequences would be?
Yeah.
We should have, anyway, is what I'm suggesting here. Along with that, many churches told their members that it is a virtue to stay home on Sunday mornings, and that it's not an emergency to just to watch a Sunday morning sermon and the Lord's Supper. Again, I'm not trying to step on toes or say it wasn't a complex situation. It was, okay? And I feel for anybody who led a church during that time. But there's a difference between saying staying home is an emergency stopgap that we have to do right now, that is not ideal. And if you're sick, if you're, you know, think you're sick, or if you're unable to get out, if you remain shut in because of that, then watching this from a distance is a good thing to do in an emergency situation. It's one thing to say that. It's another thing to say, it's the same thing. It's okay. It's just as good as this. See what I'm saying? And I heard a lot of churches. Thankfully, I don't know the churches here in Midland, so I don't know if you did this or not. Okay, so I'm not talking about you, unless I am. Other churches just said it's the same because we wanted people to feel okay about this. So I get that. But most of the people that were worried about this anyway, you know, didn't need to hear that. They knew it was an emergency. They were ready to do that. Okay. I'm just saying, what's been the consequence of that? Again, in most churches I know, it's an attrition problem. We don't have the same attendance we had before. And it's, you know, the cause and effect. You tell people it's the same thing, then people might start to think it's the same thing. If they actually believe you. All right? And a lot of people didn't need a lot of encouragement to kind of sleep in and stay home in their pajamas on a Sunday morning. Yeah. That's tempting to me some days. Okay. We'll be honest here. All right, so again, the main point here is, as a society, we still struggle to connect the dots sometimes on the most important questions of life. We're still pretty good at reading the sky. But what about the big questions that really affect us and affect our relationship with God? So Jesus challenges us here to discern the signs of the times, to observe our world, to see the patterns, to find our calling, to engage the world in an informed way, to engage our culture, even our secular culture, in a way that's observant and helpful for the church. This is Jesus' command here. Okay. So what I want to do today is talk about leading through cultural change. And part of that just means talking about the cultural change. So I've just divided this into two main sections, diagnosis and prescription. So you understand, I think, what I'm talking about there. It's to see a problem. This is the diagnosis part of this. You see a problem, but you also need to understand it as a problem, right? I mean, you can see something happening, but you might just dismiss it. All right. No, you need to, if it is a problem, you need to assess, is this a problem, and then see it as a problem. If it is a problem, and it's a problem, if it's a problem, we can do something about. Some problems we can't. I get it. Okay, you need to, wisdom, part of wisdom is to know the difference between things you can change and things you can't. Okay. But if it's something that we can do something about, then you need a correct diagnosis if you're going to try to fix the problem. Right. To give a good or relevant prescription, fix it. A few weeks ago, I was walking in my house and I looked down on the floor and noticed like splatters of water, little pool of water, but it was a good splash. Kind of. And like, wasn't the cats, okay, it is water, first question. And then the next thing I do is, you know, I see water, I see, look up, all right. Sure enough, coming through like the ceiling and the sheetrock there, it's bulging right next to the air conditioning vent. So I see this, and I did see it as a problem. Okay, so that's what I mean. It's one thing just to see it and say, oh, well, the water doesn't hurt anybody, it'll dry. No, this is a problem, all right? So we got to do something about it. And I saw it next to the air conditioning vent. So my mind immediately went to air conditioning, okay? And, you know, at least in that part of Texas, a little more humid in here. Sometimes mildew can build up in the pipes or whatever. So, but there are releases for that. Never seen it coming through here, but I had a leak before up in the house. I did not want this again. So I dropped everything. I'm going to figure out what this is. I first turned the air off. I thought, maybe that did it, okay? So now, you know, it's not leaking anymore. So we stopped the leak, is all I'm saying. And maybe I need to call an air conditioning guy. I have no idea where this is coming from. I'm going to tear up the ceiling. 30 minutes later, I noticed, oh, it's still, there's a little drip there. So I'm drying it up as much as I can. Opened up the vent and everything. Anyway, because it wasn't the air conditioning at all. So I kind of measure, you know, from the, I don't know if this is the way to do this, but, you know, back of my house on the bottom floor to the side of the house, tape measure, and I go upstairs and do the same thing and X marks the spot. A bathtub of water is filled up. For another reason I'll have to tell you about maybe during the break. Something to do with the cats. But there's a bathtub of water. Vinegar had been put in there, probably ate away. Anyway, it was dripping from the bathtub, from the stopped up bathtub, okay, from the drain area. So it's just interesting. We know how to diagnose the problem so that we can fix it. Okay, that's all that was about. What was also interesting to me is how sometimes we don't get the right diagnosis at first, you know. And seeing it next to the air conditioning vent, I know nothing about home repair. So that threw me off at first. It threw me off for about 30 minutes trying to think about air conditioning when I was on the wrong track there. That can happen sometimes with complex problems and issues in our society, all right? But that's what this is about, is identifying the problem, trying to understand it as best we can, and then fix it. So it helps to know a lot about home repair when something in the house breaks like that. What are our tools for discerning the signs of the times and trying to figure out problems in our society? There are many, okay, tools of observation. One of them is historical perspective. I can't stress enough the importance of just understanding history. Understanding history. World history, our national history, church history. It's all so important for understanding how we got to where we are. Also understanding that history is often a series of pendulum swings, right? Do you know this analogy? Okay, the pendulum swings far this direction, and then you get reactions to that thing, whatever it is, and often overreactions to it. So to make sure to know where we are on the pendulum swing, you need some historical perspective. To know where it was before yesterday and before we were born, maybe, that got us to where we are now. Where we are on that pendulum trajectory, okay? And maybe we don't need to be overreacting against something because that's going to take us also to another extreme that we don't want to be at. Maybe we need to be pushing against the pendulum as it's swinging, okay? But just to know where that is and where we are, we need to know. So, on diagnosis, I only have like 15 minutes left for that now, so we're going to hurry through this. But what's new? The question here is, what's happening now? What's new, and how did we get here? Okay, that's the question of diagnosis here. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "Men have forgotten God. That's why all of this has happened." Men have forgotten. That's why all this is everything, okay? And this is from someone who was persecuted as a Christian by the Soviet Empire in the Gulag, okay? So he knows what this is and why this has happened, because men have forgotten God. So what happens when a society forgets God? Well, what are some biblical descriptions of what happens when a people or a society or a culture forgets God? Psalm 14:1. The fool says in his heart, "There is no God." Right? So what happens when, not necessarily atheist, "I don't believe in God," sort of forgetting God, but just, you know, putting God on the back burner, whatever that is, forgetting God. We replace God with something else. That happens. All right. We become our own God. Then we get to call the shots. Well, Judges 21:25 comes to mind. "There was no king in Israel. Each," what? "Did what was right in his own eyes." Do you think that's a fair description of our culture? Isaiah 5:20. Somewhere there in the Old Testament. Hang with me. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. But darkness for life, light for darkness. Seems like a fair description. And then Luke 11, 24 and 25. Maybe 26 there. This is Jesus again. And he says, when an evil spirit comes out of anyone, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to the house I left. When it arrives, it finds the house swept clean and put in order. Then it goes and takes seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that person is worse than the first. Sort of an obscure point or passage there, perhaps. And Jesus is talking about the human soul. Okay, when he says it goes, you know, arid places and returns and all that, at the end, it's clear you're talking about a person. Okay, he says, because the condition of this person is worse than it was before. So he's using an analogy, a metaphor here of place. What happens when that evil spirit leaves, or any spirit leaves? It leaves an empty space. Okay. It leaves a vacuum, a void that needs to be filled, and will be filled by something. So what happens in that empty space if it's not filled with good? Right. Something much, much worse. All right. So other scriptures come to mind. Maybe you're thinking of others. In some ways, the Bible really hammers this point home, is that when people forget God, bad things happen, right? So spend more time and say, you know, what passages come to your mind? There are a lot there, okay? But I think these are just representative and, you know, sort of get us thinking about this. Fyodor Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov puts it like this. This character, Ivan, says, without God, all things are lawful. Sounds like Judges 21, but it's right. Without God, this is the atheist in the story that's saying this. Without God, all things are lawful. How wonderful. Okay? How magnificent. But what is going to keep men good? All right. That's the question. There's no transcendent ground of the moral order. Then on what basis do you say anything is even right or wrong? How do you even call anything good or evil? Right? To say something is good or evil is to assume that there's a ground of that goodness or lack of goodness. So what about now? Okay, we live in a post-Christian society. So that implies there was a pre-Christian society. All right. Think of the Roman Empire in, you know, before the 4th century. There was a Christian society, or Christendom, we can call it, where Christianity was the dominant faith in the culture, Western culture, in Europe and in the United States. And then there is the post-Christian culture or society. That's where we are now. Okay. So post-Christian is like, say there's a similarity here, it's like pre-Christian, pre-Constantinian society in this way. The church was a marginalized minority. So if we want some wisdom for how to live as a marginalized minority, we would do well to look at our history, but also at the early pre-Christian Roman Empire history. I think it's also worth observing, and there are books and people who do that and draw those connections. Those are helpful. Also, post-Christian society is unlike pre-Christian in a very important way. Okay? In this way, our society, our post-Christian society, has been through Christianity. Has seen it, or at least some version of it, thinks it's seen it and knows it, thinks it knows it, that's important here, and has rejected it and moved on to something else. What that something else is, we'll talk about here in a moment. Ultimately, it's nihilism. Okay, but the point is, it's different from the early church in this way. Christianity is not the new faith that has not been known and not yet accepted. It is the old one now that post-Christian society regards as obsolete and irrelevant. That's a different challenge for us. We need to be clear-eyed about it. Okay? It's a long time coming, all of this. I want to say, again, historical perspective is important here. This did not start, even if it feels like it might have, this did not start 10 or 20 or 50 years ago, all right? Those things are consequences of something that started centuries ago. So what I want to talk about here is what I'll just call marks of the post-Christian society. I don't know if these are, and I say that because I don't know if these are causes or symptoms. It's both, I think, okay? And they reinforce one another. But here are some markers, all right? One is what Max Weber over a century ago called disenchantment. Disenchantment. It's not necessarily my favorite word for describing this, but it's the emptying physical reality of any spiritual reality. Okay. Enchantment, the positive thing here would be seeing the spiritual realities all around us and knowing they're there in the physical world, sensing that, acknowledging those spiritual realities that infuse nature. Disenchantment separates those two things into two realities that never touch one another. And then finally, discarding the spiritual reality. That would be disenchantment. And so the void that's created by expelling the supernatural, or let's just say expelling God from public discourse, and then even eventually from private faith, private spheres, that's the demon. And using, you know, their just spiritual reality in general, that leaves the place and leaves an emptiness there. It's disenchantment. No spirits, no angels or demons, no God eventually. Maybe a deist sort of God, where God is out there, he doesn't really care much about us, doesn't do anything, all right? And maybe we call on him when we need something. Maybe we need to feel better about ourselves. We'll call on God. Otherwise, God, you know, if he's there at all, he doesn't seem to care or do much. And for many others, of course, we don't know if he's there, or they just positively say he's not. This is the logical outcome of this disenchantment. That's a mark of a post-Christian society. All right. This, again, is a long time coming. I'd love to go into the history of the Reformation and the consequences of that and the 30 years war that came from that, but I'll try to sum it up in two sentences. Doubt about theology and God was infused into Western culture when people started rejecting the institutional church. Reforms needed to happen, okay, but people began to doubt. And then there was conflict. Catholic-Protestant conflict, but then there were just the conflicts of the rising modern nation-state. And that's what the 30 Years' War was. 1618 to 1648, the most devastating war in Europe's history before World War I. Okay? Absolutely devastating. Truce of Westphalia in 1648 was a truce of exhaustion. They were tired. Okay. And what came of that, the propaganda that came of that, was that these were religious wars, okay? They were really wars motivated, mainly that motivate all wars, greed and power and resources, but, and grudges even. But they were seen as wars of religion. Well, we're looking for something that can help unite us again. And Europe decided, Western culture decided, it's not the Bible. It's not theology. In fact, those things put us into conflict with each other, okay? So what do we need? We need to rely on human reason. Okay? Human reason, which Christian theology had always said is an important aspect of our Christian faith, human reason. But they also knew its place. Human reason can be fallible. It can be subject to our passions and emotions too much. We can rationalize anything we want through human reason. Okay? It's not the thing that we trust most. It's not the thing that's going to lead us to all truth. What the Enlightenment did is say, no, reason will lead us to all truth. That's what we will rely on. That's what we'll exalt above everything else, above scripture, above Christian tradition, above emotion, above everything, human reason. And in the post-Enlightenment, David Hume and others said, actually, if you follow that to its logical conclusion, human reason does nothing for you. You can't prove human reason. Every act of human reason is an act of faith. Human reason does nothing. And so instead of putting it back in its place, they put it down at the bottom and rejected all reliance on reason. Which that may explain why you get some, you know, in our own culture, it seems like people really exalt reason a lot still. And then on the other hand, you can't even make a reasonable argument with people about things. Who cares about reason? That was more than two sentences. I'm sorry. I think there was a couple semicolons in there, but that was the short version. All right. All of that as a result of disenchantment. So the turn toward and then later against reason. And now we sort of, in some ways, schizophrenic on that. Okay. And of course, reason is everything, or reason is nothing. Desecration. This is something that Carl Truman talks about. And he says it this way: desecration speaks to the exaltation, that active destruction of the holy involves. So this is positive destruction of what was once sacred. Right? It's the second step. God has been pushed out, right? So the spiritual world has been pushed out. Now the seven evil spirits come home to roost. That's desecration. What Truman is saying is exuberance over this active destruction of the holy. So it's both blasphemy, and then it's exhilaration over the blasphemy. Aren't we happy about replacing God with something that's totally opposite? That's desecration. One example from earlier this year was the funeral for transgender activist Cecilia Gentile. I didn't know who this person was, so if you've never heard the name, you're excused for that. But Cecilia Gentile was a transgender activist, a man who identified as a woman, a self-described atheist, and died, sadly, of a drug overdose on February 6th of this year. On February 15th, the funeral mass was held at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan, an active Catholic church. Among other things at this funeral, Gentile was eulogized, I'm quoting, as St. Cecilia, the mother of all whores. Eric Zuber about this. So it's not enough, you see, and this is just an illustration, it's not enough to empty the sacred space of its worshipers and of the holy. We must fill it, defile it, and fill it with sacrilege. The same reason Antiochus IV in the 2nd century BC sacrificed a pig on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. We can't just stop sacrifices, we're going to defile it, we're going to desecrate. Okay. Mary Harrington talks about normophobia. Normophobia. What's normal? Name something that's normal 20 years ago.
The sun.
Okay, you got me on that one. That's hard to stand against, I guess. Name something in the church that was normal 20 years ago, or just in society as a cultural thing. All right.
Blue laws.
Okay. So things were closed on Sundays. Business was limited on Sundays. Where I live, Chick-fil-A, that's the only thing now. The self limits there. But also, again, for time's sake, I'll throw out some examples here. The Wall Street Journal did a survey in 1998 and in 2024 and asked Americans these questions. Is patriotism very important to you? In 1998, 70% said yes. In 2024, 38%. Is religion very important to you? In 1998, 62% of Americans said yes. Strong majority. Today, 37% said yes. Is having children very important to you? 59% said yes in 98, and now 30% of Americans say yes. And it just means not important to you personally, just is that a very important thing? Okay, is the point here on all of these points. So things are changing, okay? What was normal before is not normal now. Normophobia, all right? So I can say marriage between one man and one woman, seen in Christian thought as a sacred thing. Now, heteronormativity is something we're against as a society. There is movement against the nuclear family itself, and of course Christianity itself. Reactions against all of these as part of the desecration. There is also the erasure of history. There is identity crisis. I think this one is huge. Who am I? We are taught to question now the most basic things about ourselves and then to create our own identity from scratch. Again, if this sounds foreign to you, that means you're older than I am. All right? To everyone younger than I am, yeah, that's the way it is now. All right? That identity that we're asked to form for ourselves is unstable, it's liquid, it's subject to the present feelings of the individual. And as you know, feelings are variable and stable. This is also marked by what Charles Taylor calls expressive individualism, or Philip Reeve called psychological man, in which the categories of identity politics dominate. So that individual meaning and identity are psychological. They're made real through expressing them. Not just to make it known, but then to coerce widespread embracing and celebration of that identity. Last thing I'll say here, and then we'll have a break, is Aaron Wren identified three distinct attitudes in American society toward Christianity in recent decades. That attitude, he says, goes from positive to neutral to negative. So Christianity lived in the positive world, he says, up until around 1994. Okay. And then around 94, it moved to about 2014, for 20 years, the neutral world, what do you call it? And then since 2014, the negative world. Okay. Again, the point here is, what's American society's attitude toward Christianity? It was positive, okay, for most of the country's history. There was, you can't just go straight from positive to negative overnight. So there's a period of about 20 years of transition there where it's a neutrality, all right? And then now it is negative, hostile, all right? So just as an example, in the pro-Christian positive world, you know, so let's say someone is works as an industrial engineer, all right, and at his job. Larry's an industrial engineer, and he's a Christian. That's good. That's great. In the negative world, it's like, Larry's an industrial engineer, and he's a Christian. See the difference there? I'm not a good actor, but maybe you can help. All right. In the first scenario, it's like a positive thing for him. It may be helpful to his career. for Larry to be a Christian also. It has nothing to do with his job as an industrial engineer, but people like that. People like Christianity and what it teaches and what it stands for and all that. Okay. In the negative world, it's a liability for him to be a Christian and to express the belief, to just believe, not even have to express them, just to believe the things he believes. It's seen as a threat and a very negative thing. Okay. So it's not that it shifted suddenly in those years, and certainly in some places in our country, it was negative long before 2014. In some places, it's still a positive, or, you know, depending on your field, you know, it still may be a positive. I minister in churches a lot. It's good for me to be a Christian, okay? That's a positive thing for us, okay? But it's overall turning into a negative characteristic, all right? It's not just a neutral thing like your color of your hair or whatever. It's now a disadvantage. The setting now is anti-Christian. So it's a simplistic typology in many ways, but just sort of, I think, gets the point across that in most American regions and subcultures now, at present, being an Orthodox Christian with a traditional ethic is a disadvantage. So if it's not here yet, it's coming. Quick